Right now, you probably have a smartphone sitting in their desk next to you, or maybe it's in your pocket.
Yeah, that's pretty much a guarantee for all of us.
Right, and you haven't touched it, it hasn't chimed, and yet in the background, it could be secretly turning on its microphone and sending your conversations to a server thousands of miles away.
Which is a terrifying thought.
It really is. And the most unsettling part, you wouldn't have made a single mistake to let them in. So welcome to another deep dive.
Glad to be here for this one.
We are taking a stack of sources today, basically extracting the most vital insights from a really fascinating edition of the Tikkenite newsletter.
Yeah, the sources today are packed.
They really are. Oh. And the mission for this deep dive is to explore this high-stakes intersection of technology, corporate strategy, and consumer trust.
Which is a remarkably fragile ecosystem, you know? We tend to assume that when massive multi-billion dollar companies roll out a strategy or a government secures its communications, there's this flawless blueprint.
Like they have it all figured out.
Exactly. But today's sources show us what happens when that blueprint just completely collides with reality.
So we're looking at a bizarre mix of stories today that all actually tie together. We've got gaming industry triumphs, some baffling corporate self-sabotage, and then a real-world digital security scandal.
Yeah, that spyware story is wild.
Right. A European politician whose literal job was hunting for spies became the victim of an invisible digital weapon. So the question we're exploring for you today is, you know, how do these massive entities manage to accidentally sabotage their own products?
And what happens when the hardware we rely on gets weaponized against us?
Exactly.
Because whether we're looking at video game consoles or software development or international spyware, the central theme here is the dangerous gap between ambitious corporate strategies and real-world execution.
We're looking at what happens when companies rush timelines, right? Before the market or even the product itself is actually ready. So, okay, let's unpack this for a second by starting with a company that seems to have completely misunderstood its own customer base. And that's Sony.
Oh, the disk drive situation?
Yes, they are in the middle of a really strange situation with this massive shortage of PlayStation 5 disk drives.
Yeah, it's a bit of a mess right now.
A few months ago, Sony announced they are ending the production of physical game discs by January 2028. They are drawing a hard line in the sand for a digital-only future.
Right, which makes sense on paper.
Sure, but instead of gamers just, you know, quietly accepting digital downloads, it triggered a massive panic buying spree.
Unbelievable.
People are buying up their $79.99 detachable PS5 disk drives, like hoarding them to save their physical collections.
Which you can't really blame them for.
No, especially given Sony's history. They eventually shut down their legacy digital storefronts, like they do with the PSP, the PS3, and the Vita. It makes perfect sense that players want a physical backup.
It's just human nature to want to own your stuff.
Right. And it's like a city announcing they're shutting off the water supply next week and then acting shocked when every store sells out of bottled water.
That is a great way to look at it.
Now, Sony is limiting sales to one drive per order, and scalpers are flipping them for up to $150 to $200 online.
What's fascinating here is that it's a perfect look at the messy adolescence of digital ownership. Sony's leadership looked at the data and clearly thought, consumers are ready for a digital-only ecosystem.
But they miscalculated.
Big time. They completely underestimated the attachment players have to physical media.
But I'm going to push back on that a bit, actually. Is this really a failure of market research, or is it just a basic failure of supply chain logistics? I mean, if Sony had just manufactured enough disk drives to meet the demand, wouldn't this digital shift have gone smoothly?
Well, it's a fair question, but it goes deeper than logistics, I think. The insight here is that physical components are no longer just media players.
What do you mean?
They've essentially become physical DRM keys. When you put a disc in a modern console, you aren't really playing the game off the disc anymore.
Right, the console's just reading the disc to verify you actually have the license to play it.
Exactly. And then it downloads the massive game files from the internet anyway. So Sony assumed that because players are already downloading the data, they wouldn't care about losing the little plastic disc.
I see.
But what they failed to research was the psychology of ownership. A physical disc is a guarantee that you can play that game 10 years from now, even if Sony's servers go completely dark.
Which they have done in the past.
Right. By announcing the 2028 cutoff, they turned a gradual, natural market shift into a sudden crisis of scarcity.
That makes a lot of sense. They kind of forced the issue and broke the trust.
Yep, they backed themselves into a corner.
But While Sony is currently dealing with the fallout of rushing a strategy, CD Projekt Red is finally seeing the payoff of fixing a rushed product.
A very expensive fix.
Very. We have an update on Cyberpunk 2077. As of July 2026, the game has officially hit 40 million sales.
Wow.
Yeah, and that includes 5 million copies sold just since last November 2025.
Which is an incredible turnaround when you consider the absolute state of that game at launch.
Oh, man. If we rewind to December 2020, Cyberpunk was like one of the most disastrous releases in modern gaming.
It was completely unplayable for a lot of people.
It crashed constantly, the AI was broken, and the performance on older consoles was so unacceptable that Sony actually pulled it from the PlayStation Store entirely.
I remember Microsoft had to issue mass refunds too.
Right, but they didn't walk away. They spent years fixing it. They released the Phantom Liberty expansion in 2023. There was the highly successful Netflix Edrunners anime, and now it's a massive hit.
They really pulled it back from the brink.
But looking at these sales numbers, is this a dangerous lesson? Like, does this teach big studios that they can launch a broken game at full price, use the players as beta testers, and still make a fortune 3 years later when it goes on discount?
You would think so, but the underlying mechanics of this turnaround make it nearly impossible to replicate.
Why is that?
Because CD Projekt Red didn't just, patch a few visual glitches. They spent over 2 full years rebuilding core systems from the ground up.
Like what kind of systems?
Memory management, pedestrian AI routing, the physics engines.
I try to imagine doing that, and it sounds a bit like attempting to replace the concrete foundation of a skyscraper while people are actively living in the penthouse.
That is an excellent analogy, actually. The sheer resources required to pull that off without collapsing the entire structure are staggering.
Yeah, I imagine most studios couldn't afford that.
Not at all. Most development studios simply do not have the financial runway to survive a 2-year repair phase with zero new revenue coming in. They would just go bankrupt.
Right, so it's not a viable strategy.
No, rather than providing a blueprint for bad behavior, this serves as a rare, incredibly expensive cautionary tale. It cost them millions to buy back their reputation so they could establish a foundation for their future universe projects.
And it seems like the rest of the industry is taking that expensive lesson to heart. We are seeing a distinct shift in how studios handle release dates now.
People are finally realizing patience is ultimately cheaper than patches.
Yes. For example, Spike Chunsoft just announced they are delaying the highly anticipated visual novel Danganronpa 2x2.
Ah.
Yeah, they're pushing it all the way to early 2027 to deliver the best possible experience. So what does this all mean for the players? Are we finally entering an era where patience is winning out over corporate quarterly earnings?
I think we are. The consumer psychology surrounding delays has fundamentally changed in the sort of post-cyberpunk, post-No Man's Sky era.
How so? Because, a delay used to mean a game was in development hell.
It did, yeah.
Yeah.
But after these high-profile disasters where games were clearly pushed out just to meet a quarterly earnings report, gamers have become highly skeptical of rigid release dates.
Makes sense.
Now, a delay is often treated as positive public relations. Players would much rather wait an extra year for a polished game than spend $70 on a frustrating, broken mess.
Especially for a visual novel, right? Like Danganronpa.
Exactly. For a company like Spike Chunsoft, protecting a narrative-heavy, puzzle-heavy intellectual property is paramount.
Because if a puzzle system is bugged or a text trigger fails in a game that is entirely about solving a mystery, the entire immersion is completely ruined. You can't just patch a ruined plot twist a month later.
Precisely. By prioritizing quality over a specific financial quarter, they are protecting their long-term brand equity.
So we've spent this whole time looking at what happens when software development timelines fail us. But software delays are one thing. You wait and you eventually get a working game.
Usually, anyway.
Right. But there's a different kind of failure that is much harder to fix. What happens when the physical hardware itself fails you right out of the box?
Well, hardware launches are brutal.
They really are. We have two completely different hardware scenarios unfolding right now, starting with Valve. Valve usually has incredibly solid hardware, like we saw with the Steam Deck.
Yeah, the Steam Deck is solid.
But their new premium device, the $1,500 Steam Machine, is facing a severe issue.
The initial reports on this are pointing to a really critical manufacturing flaw.
Yeah, so here's where it gets really interesting, or I guess concerning. A user reported that their GPU completely died after just a few minutes of normal gaming.
Just minutes in.
Minutes. They weren't overclocking it. They weren't pushing the limits. But the machine died and displayed a stark red line across the screen.
Oh, boy.
The internet is already calling it the red line of death. It's like buying a luxury sports car that breaks down before you even drive it off the dealership lot.
And that specific naming convention, the red line of death, carries a massive amount of historical weight in the gaming community.
Yeah, it really does.
It draws a direct parallel to the mid-2000s with the Xbox 360's infamous Red Ring of Death.
Okay, so what actually causes a failure like that? Like when a GPU just dies out of nowhere on a brand new $1,500 machine?
Well, in high-performance compact hardware, it usually comes down to manufacturing tolerances and thermal management.
Like overheating?
Essentially. When a GPU heats up during gameplay and then cools down when you turn it off, the physical components expand and contract.
Right.
In the case of the Xbox 360, that constant thermal expansion was actually breaking the tiny lead-free solder joints connecting the graphics chip to the motherboard.
Oh, wow. Just from heating and cooling.
Yeah. It caused a catastrophic hardware failure rate, estimated somewhere between 23 to 54%.
That is insane.
It cost Microsoft billions in extended warranties. If Valve's Steam machine is suffering from a similar thermal or soldering flaw at a $1,500 price point, the trust damage is going to be immense.
Even if their support is good.
Right. Regardless of how good their customer support is at replacing the units, the viral reputation damage is already done.
That makes the stakes so much clearer. It's not just a bad batch of code you can patch. It's physical physics breaking down the machine. Which brings us perfectly to the other side of the hardware spectrum. Nintendo. While Valve is dealing with this hardware nightmare, Nintendo is reportedly gearing up for a potential hardware dream with their next generation.
The Switch 2 rumors are really heating up.
They're solidifying, specifically because Square Enix has indirectly confirmed they're exploring putting Final Fantasy XV on it.
Which would be a huge get.
Huge. And the leaked specs suggest an NVIDIA custom Tegra 8-nanometer chip, 12 gigabytes of RAM, and about 4 teraflops of performance when docked.
That's a serious upgrade from the original Switch.
It is. But I have to admit, I need a quick refresher here. What does an 8-nanometer chip actually mean for a handheld console, you know, in plain English?
Okay, so the nanometer measurement refers to the physical size of the transistors on the microchip.
Okay.
Without getting too deep into the weeds, when you shrink the transistors down to 8 nanometers, you can pack billions more of them into the exact same physical space.
So more brain power in the same box.
Yes. But more importantly, for a handheld device like the Switch, smaller transistors mean the electrical current has a shorter distance to travel.
Ah, so it uses less battery power and generates less heat.
Exactly. It provides a massive leap in processing power while keeping the thermal load manageable, which is crucial if you are holding the device in your hands and, you know, don't want a noisy fan spinning constantly.
Right. Okay, but I still have to play devil's advocate for a second.
Go for it.
We are talking about running Final Fantasy XV, a game that made traditional home consoles sweat. Nintendo is famous for optimizing their own games, sure, but you can't beat physics.
Very true.
If a tiny hybrid tablet doesn't have the raw hardware power of a PlayStation, won't a massive third-party game just be a blurry, stuttering mess?
If they relied solely on raw hardware power, yes, it would be a blurry mess.
Right.
But the critical component of that NVIDIA chip isn't just the physical architecture, it's the algorithmic upscaling.
Like what?
Technologies like NVIDIA's DLSS Deep Learning Super Sampling or AMD's FSR.
How does that actually work in practice?
Think of it this way. Rendering a game in crisp 4K resolution requires an immense amount of computational power, which drains batteries and creates heat.
Makes sense.
So instead of forcing the hardware to render the game at 4K, the console intentionally renders the game at a much lower resolution, say 720p. It's much less taxing on the system.
Okay, but then it looks terrible on a big screen.
That's where the magic happens. A dedicated neural network on the chip takes that low-resolution image and mathematically predicts what the missing pixels should look like, based on thousands of hours of training on high-resolution images.
Oh, wait, really?
Yeah, it injects those newly generated pixels into the frame in real time.
So the console is essentially hallucinating the high-definition details on the fly, saving all that processing power.
Precisely. It allows a handheld device to output an image that looks incredibly sharp and runs smoothly without physically melting the hardware.
That is wild.
It is. And if Nintendo successfully implements this, it bridges a massive gap. The first Switch missed out on so many major multi-platform AAA games.
It really did.
This means players won't need a separate console to play massive third-party games alongside their Nintendo exclusives. It unifies the casual and hardcore markets into one ecosystem.
It is crazy to think about a neural network drawing in details where you were jumping around in a game.
The tech has come a long way.
It has. But, you know, we've spent this whole time looking at what happens when hardware fails us due to manufacturing errors, or how it can be pushed to its limits with clever software.
Right.
But there is a much more terrifying hardware scenario.
Yeah.
What happens when your device functions perfectly, doing exactly what it's told, but it's taking orders from someone else?
Yeah, this next story is heavy.
We are moving to a shocking security report from Citizen Lab regarding Stelios Kouloglou, a former European Parliament member.
This story completely elevates the stakes from, you know, consumer frustration to actual geopolitical security.
Totally. And the movie-like irony here is so thick. Kouloglou wasn't just any Parliament member. He sat on the specific committee investigating the abuse of commercial spyware.
You can't make it up.
You really can't. And he recently discovered that his own personal phone was infected multiple times by Pegasus, the exact spyware his committee was investigating. The spy hunter had spies sitting in his pocket the entire time.
It raises profound questions about the integrity of the institutions we rely on, really. Pegasus, which is developed by the Israeli NSO group, is a prime example of a zero-click exploit.
Okay, we hear the term zero-click thrown around a lot in security news, but how does it actually infiltrate a phone without the user doing anything?
Well, most traditional malware requires user interaction. You have to be tricked into clicking a suspicious link in an email or downloading a malicious PDF.
Just to make a mistake.
Right. But a zero-click exploit bypasses the user entirely. It targets the background processes of the phone.
Oh, so?
For instance, native messaging apps like iMessage are designed for convenience. When someone texts you an image or a link, the app automatically parses that data in the background to generate a little preview thumbnail before you even open the message.
Oh, I see. So the phone is just trying to be helpful by loading the image so it's ready when I look at it.
Correct. But an image file isn't just a simple grid of colors. It's complex data that the phone's rendering engine has to read and translate.
Right.
Hackers find microscopic vulnerabilities in that parsing code. They hide executable malicious code inside a seemingly harmless image file.
Wow.
The moment your phone receives the message, it attempts to generate the preview thumbnail and accidentally executes the hacker's code in the background.
And the message doesn't even have to make a notification sound, does it? You just receive it and you're compromised.
Yes. And once the spyware is in, it grants the attacker complete remote access to the device. They can silently activate the microphone, turn on the camera, read your encrypted messages before the encryption app scrambles them, and just harvest your passwords.
That is the ultimate insight here. The very features designed for our convenience, the auto-loading previews, the seamless integration are the exact structural weaknesses being weaponized against us.
It's a sobering reality.
Now, looking at the geopolitical reality of this impartially, if a high-value target, like an EU Parliament member investigating spyware, is vulnerable to this, it means no one is truly insulated.
Absolutely. This raises an important question about our systems.
Right, because the sources highlight that digital security is no longer an abstract philosophical debate about personal privacy. It is a structural necessity for the functioning of democratic institutions. If the watchdogs can be invisibly watched, the entire system of oversight breaks down.
It absolutely does. And it's worth noting these exploits cost millions of dollars to develop and deploy, meaning they are primarily the tools of nation states and highly funded intelligence agencies.
Which leads to the obvious question. What does this mean for you, the listener, right now? The sources provide actionable advice, particularly if you work in a sensitive field like journalism, law, or activism.
Yeah, the advice here is critical.
First, you have to operate under the assumption that your device could be compromised. It requires a total shift in mindset. Second, obsessively update your operating system. Those annoying software updates are often emergency patches, specifically designed to close the vulnerabilities that zero-click attacks rely on.
Don't ignore the updates, folks.
Exactly. Finally, the experts advise using end-to-end encrypted apps like Signal for Communication, and critically, avoiding native apps like iMessage or FaceTime for highly sensitive conversations.
Right, because their deep integration with the phone's operating system has historically made them primary targets for these exploits.
So as we pull all of these threads together, we've covered everything from disk drives and neural networks to international spyware.
But it all hinges on one core concept, really, trust, and the consequences of mismanaging it.
Yeah, that's a great point.
Consider Sony's disk drive shortage. By aggressively pushing a digital mandate without understanding the psychology of their consumers, they fracture trust. They're reminding players that physical hardware is now just a DRM key.
And CD Projekt Red had to spend 2 agonizing years and millions of dollars rebuilding the foundation of their game just to buy back the trust they broke with a rushed launch.
Exactly. And then you have Valve, where a manufacturing flaw resulting in the red line of death immediately shatters the trust inherent in a $1,500 purchase.
Yeah, you expect it to work at that price.
Right. But the ultimate breach of trust is the Pegasus scandal. It forces us to confront the reality that the devices we carry every day, the hardware we implicitly trust with our most private thoughts and conversations, can be silently compromised using the very convenience features we love.
And that is why you need to care about the mechanisms behind these stories. As a consumer and a citizen, your privacy, your digital purchases, and your expectations are constantly being tested by these massive entities.
It requires immense caution.
It does. Which leaves you with a final thought to mull over after this deep dive is done. We started by talking about the blueprint of corporate strategy and the illusion of control. Well, if a digital-only future means our game libraries can be erased the moment a server shuts down, and our personal devices can be silently turned into zero-click spies without us making a single mistake.
Yeah.
Are we ever truly owning our technology anymore? Or are we essentially just renting our digital lives from entities we can never fully trust?
That's a heavy thought to leave on.
It is. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the information around you, and we'll see you next time.